This Black Friday, get 6 months free when you move your WordPress sites to Kinsta. Enjoy faster load times, no stress when traffic spikes, and hosting you can actually count on. We're G2's number one rated host for WordPress. For a reason. Visit kinsta.com/BF. That's KINSTA.com/BF. Don't miss out. Offer ends December 2nd.
We should give you one for that stupid Margaret Thatcher movie. We should do that. You know.
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region. No guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
She is disgusting. She is lying. She is deceitful. She is two-faced. She is conniving. And she is dishonest.
Yes. Isn't she wonderful?
Hello, everyone. It's Wreckatopia, episode 189. My name is Chris Atkinson, joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, dirty rotten scoundrel Renos.
There you go. There you go.
Much effort.
Don't put any thought into it, Aaron. Put as little thought into it as possible. And we also welcome Jeremy Scott.
Hello, everybody.
And today's big recommend is Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. We'd also like to welcome chat, who have come out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. We appreciate you guys very much.
I was going
to
go with Glenn Hetty is underrated Arenos, because
that
was,
I would have liked that.
My main takeaway this time was how underrated.
I would have liked that. That's we definitely didn't see enough Glenn Hetty back in the day. So all right. Let's get on to our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
And I revisited a movie that I saw in theaters long ago, and I bought the DVD for a couple years ago, and I wanted to rewatch it. It's called The Red Violin. Mm-hmm. This won Best Original Score in 1999. I think a lot of people... I don't know if a lot of people have seen this movie or have heard of it. It seemed like it went under the radar even then, and it's been since then. I don't hear much about it. It was hard to find on streaming, but you can find it on Tubi these days, I think. The story of The Red Violin is basically you start at an auction house where there is this very famous red violin that's going to be sold. It kind of does this thing with time where it will show you a certain bidders on the red violin, and they have a certain personal reason for being there to bid on it and everything. Then the movie will come back and tell you a story of, first off, how the red violin was made, and then the red violin takes a journey, and we see all the different stories that involve this red violin, all the times where it moved from one owner to the next, and so on and so forth. Hmm. And then it'll come back to the auction, and it takes you back in time a little bit and says, okay, we focused on this one bidder, now we're going to look at this other bidder, and it shows them what their personal connection is to it. Samuel L. Jackson is in this movie. Greta Scacchi is in this movie, but basically, it comes down to there was a violin maker who had a wife who was pregnant, was about to have his kid, and then she died in childbirth. The kid, I believe, died in childbirth, and so he made this very special violin with a red tint on it, and then it started moving on to others over time. It's got kind of a wicked sense of humor throughout it too, where a lot of times you think a story is going a certain way, and then completely changes what you think is going to happen, or like what you're expecting or whatever. So I like that about the movie, and this is definitely one of the most underrepresented Samuel L. Jackson movies ever made. It's just he's great in the movie, and I don't think anybody ever talks about this. So anyway, I wanted to share that one with you. It's a great one. So
For some reason, in my head, I confused this with the Jamie Foxx violinist homeless guy movie with the
can't remember Robert what that Duncan. Was called. Yeah, but I can't remember what that was called. Yeah, it came out like
I know I saw
15
this
years
back
ago
in the day, but I don't remember it at all.
I have not seen this film in the Red franchise with the red shoes and the red pill and the red red 1, 2, and 3 and whatever else might be in the franchise. I don't remember ever hearing of this movie. So this is completely new to me, and it backs up your point about it just kind of being underseen and underviewed. So I immediately put it on my watch list. So hopefully I'll get to it soon.
Yeah, it's pretty phenomenal, and I'd love to hear what other people have to say about it. I don't think I've run into anybody else who's seen it. So there you go.
Yep.
What do you got, Jeremy?
Listen up, y'all. I saw a movie with some primates, and I liked it a lot more than I expected. It's Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. When this movie was released, I had very little interest, which is weird because I love the first three, the trilogy following the life of Caesar. But when I knew that this was going to be generations later and no Caesar and no Andy Serkis, like for some reason, my brain just went, that's not going to be fun. And I just made up my mind then and there. Well, a few days ago, flipping channels, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes happened to be on HBO. And so I watched it, and then I realized they're playing War next, and then they were playing Kingdom. So I did the whole, I did all of them except for Rise. Man, this is really good. I didn't think they were going to be able to make me care in such a short time about another non-Caesar ape, but they do a good job because the technology is so great, and they're able to be so expressive, these performers in the mocap suits. And it does lift, I think, a few beats from the original Charlton Heston Planet of the Apes movie. I think they're homages. I wasn't bothered by that. And I'm curious to see if they're going to keep these going, where it goes from here. I didn't see any hints this time about astronauts being up in space. Like the first three movies, there's always some kind of background dropped about, well, those guys in space, we don't know whether they're lost or something. And I'm wondering if we're ever going to get that back to the beginning,
and then,
basically.
And then it turns out to be Mark Wahlberg all along.
Yeah. Anyway, this is on HBO Max or HBO proper if you are interested in watching it. And I was delightfully surprised by how much I enjoyed it.
I saw this. I don't think I saw it in theaters. I think it was when it first came to like Blu-ray or whatever. And I liked it. I don't remember too much about it though, at this point. I was having a really hard time coming up with the name of this one the other day. I was sitting there like, there's Rise, there's Dawn, and then there's War. What's this other one called?
Peace.
So I liked it. I thought it was good.
Yeah, I did too. I liked it quite a bit. I think my main takeaway was for this franchise, this is a good direction to go because it almost makes it anthological. Is that a way to make that word? Like it makes it an anthology, in some ways, because there aren't a lot of winks or Easter eggs in this movie. It really kind of is this, story that takes place in this timeline, in this franchise. And, you get a sense of where it's going and what's going to happen, but it's its own thing. And I really liked that. And I'm consistently amazed in these movies by the pathos I feel for these CG characters. Like I feel so much for this young ape as he grows up and tries to figure out the world around him. There's a lot of good stuff here.
It's hard to believe there's 10 Planet of the Apes movies. Can you imagine back like when the Charlton Heston original came out that people thought there'd be 10 of these by the time 2025 rolled around?
10 of these things.
Yeah. I mean, it's three different iterations of it, but still, it's crazy to think about. Well,
when I went back and watched the originals, I was blown away that they made the first four in four consecutive years. It was, that's just how they did sequels back then. Like it was just every year there was a new one that dropped. It was wild. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
Aaron, what do you got?
It is the time of year where I'm trying to catch up on Oscar contenders, so I caught the latest Yorgos Stone collaboration, Begonia. Uh-huh.
Spelled it wrong.
I liked it. That's why it's a small recommend. I don't know that I liked it as much as Poor Things. I think Poor Things is still my, like, you know, Yorgos, you know, ultimate. But Gonya might be penultimate. It's really good. I think there is a storytelling choice in this movie that I won't go into for spoiler reasons that adds an extra layer of tension and thought to this movie, which I always love coming out of a movie, like thinking about things, like processing, oh, that means this, or that means this, or, you know, what was the movie doing here now that I know this? And, you know, there's some really interesting stuff here. Plus, the performances are just amazing. Emma Stone continues to be one of, if not the greatest actor working. She's incredible. Jesse Plemons is right up there as well. He's probably going to get an Oscar nom for this for sure. And I think they both will, actually. So, yeah, I really, really loved this movie. And I'll just say it this way. When I finished it, I liked this movie. 4 hours later, I loved this movie. It's kind of one of those where it's like it just hung with me. So, yeah.
Is she currently favored to win her third Oscar?
I don't know. I haven't been keeping a huge pulse on it, but my instinct is that she is up there, but that the thinking is they won't give her her third. You know how the Academy has these things that they will or won't do, you know, like.
Yeah, so, Meryl Streep.
But yes, unless you're Meryl Streep or Daniel Day.
Meryl Streep, it's sort of like it took a while. Like even when she won them like very early on in her career or whatever. And then it like she would get nominated a million times and never win. And then finally it was like, okay, we should give you one for that stupid Margaret Thatcher movie. We should do that. You know. Might as well, you know, you had a lot of other great things that could have won, but nah, it's time to give you another Oscar, this time for the Margaret Thatcher movie.
Yep.
All right, let's get on to our big recommend, which is Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, and it was my choice, so I will take it away.
I'm fine, it's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is a 1988 film directed by Yoda. It's our second Frank Oz big recommend after The Score. It's a remake of Bedtime Story, written by Stanley Shapiro and Paul Henning, adapted here by Dale Launer. Launer co-wrote Ruthless People and was the credited screenwriter on My Cousin Vinny. The beginning of this film introduces us to con artist Lawrence Jameson, played by Michael Caine, who's pretending not to want the pearl necklace that is basically the only thing shown in the frame. A woman who believes he is royalty is trying to give him the necklace to help his country with a war they're fighting. She insists on giving him the necklace, and he constantly turns her down until finally she says, "Think of the children," and that's when Lawrence begrudgingly accepts. After an opening credit sequence, we see Lawrence talking to the corrupt local cop, Inspector Andre, played by Anton Rogers, who apparently does some of the legwork in finding Lawrence's marks. The target here is Fanny Eubanks, played by Barbara Harris, who is sitting at a roulette table. Lawrence sits next to her, and sheepishly places his bet on the exact number that Fanny has placed a large wager on. The bet loses, and Lawrence now turns to Andre to see what he can get for his royal ring, which Andre, playing his part extremely well, responds, "Not the royal ring, your highness," and is quickly shushed by the master con. Lawrence now rushes out to a courtyard with all sorts of greenery around, pretending to contemplate his predicament. Fanny tries to get confirmation that Lawrence is royalty from Andre, who tells Fanny nothing while telling her absolutely everything that counts and keeping her intrigued. Andre leaves, and Fanny Eubanks of Omaha goes to talk to the person who is obviously royalty. Lawrence keeps the subterfuge going, but also flatters Fanny by telling her how attractive she is. He then escapes the courtyard via all the bushes and trees outside of it, and Andre comes back to feed Fanny's imagination by telling her that Lawrence is emotionally vulnerable and has been a widower for 5 years. Apparently, Lawrence, in every sense of the phrase, wants to royally screw Lady Fanny right in her Omaha. The next scene confirms this as Fanny gives Lawrence an expensive brooch while they lie in bed together wearing post-coital bedwear. Lawrence then divvies up the cash from the con... Andre gets a cut, his butler Emperor Palpatine gets a cut, and after he pays himself, the remainder of the cash goes to a Swiss bank account, which means a trip on a train. On the way back to Beaumont-sur-Mer, we are introduced to Freddie Benson, played by Steve Martin, who is a way less suave, but still fairly effective con artist himself. He asks to sit at a table in the dining car with an attractive Mark, who doesn't seem to care anything about Freddy until he notes the prices of the food on the menu and orders a glass of water. The target now wonders why he only ordered water when he seemed so hungry, and he tells her that he's saving his money for his grandmother's hospital bills. The ruse is immediately detected by Lawrence at another table. The sob story gets the woman to ask for the waiter and have Freddy order whatever he wants. You immediately see the difference between Freddy's methods and Lawrence's when, with very little protest, he launches into an unapologetic large order of food and three beers. In the next scene, Freddy sneaks into a first-class cabin occupied by Lawrence. Lawrence innocently asks about the scene he just witnessed with the woman and Freddy, offering condolences to his grandmother. Freddy, having gotten what he wants and completely out of character now, doesn't even know what he's talking about at first, and then it takes very little for him to admit that he's a con artist to a total stranger. Not too long after, Freddy's explaining why he does what he does, claiming that women have been living off of men for too long. He then tells Lawrence his next stop is on the Riviera, and specifically Beaumont-sur-Mer, Lawrence's hometown, because he hears there are a lot of rich women there ready to get swindled. Lawrence, seeing the potential threat, tries to tell Freddy he's been misinformed and that Portofino on the Italian Riviera is the new hotness, which doesn't work right away. But when a gorgeous woman headed to Portofino boards the train, Freddy is convinced to go there instead. Not shockingly, we find out that Lawrence hired her to do exactly that. When Andre asks him why he needed to go to such lengths to keep a rank amateur out of this town, Lawrence tells him that the rude and uncouth cons like that who go after small scores could end up scaring all of his future marks away. Next, at a cafe, Andre reads to Lawrence from a newspaper about a clever young American con artist known as the Jackal, who has been working all over Western Europe, who Andre believes is Freddy. Lawrence asks, if he's in the newspaper, then how clever could he be? Andre starts giving him statistics on the next Mark, who shortly arrives in a white Ferrari but is carrying an unexpected passenger, Freddy, who obviously didn't stay in Portofino very long. Andre then gets to work showing the woman in the white Ferrari that what Freddy is actually doing with the money she gave him, and she presses charges, sending him to jail. With no one to vouch for him or to help him out, Freddy mentions he knows Lawrence Jameson, but not before one of the most hilarious scenes of the movie, where he futilely tries to remember his name, and Andre has to help him over the finish line. Yes! We're like this! Crossing his fingers. Lawrence arrives to the jail and after a lot more conning with Andre, tells Freddy he can get out of this by paying a $5,000 fine. Freddy claims he only has $900 after almost telling the truth about having $1,200, but Lawrence says as long as he comes up with the rest of the money in 48 hours, Andre won't submit his name to Interpol, which would prevent him from traveling in Europe ever again. This ruse appears to work until Freddy meets Fanny Eubanks on the plane back to the States. Fanny noticed that he was talking to the prince and that she believes Freddy is one of his freedom fighters, which tells Freddy he's been had by a better con artist. Freddy is just smart enough to keep playing along. We zip on over to Lawrence's mansion, where Freddy shows up like he owns the place, considering the blackmail he just acquired. All Freddy wants is to learn from the master, but threatens Lawrence's livelihood if he rejects him. With that, Lawrence agrees to be Freddy's Yoda. Andre offers Lawrence the chance to murder Freddy using an assassin who's good with a stiletto and very little real investigation. But Lawrence thinks he can get rid of Freddy by going through with the agreement, probably believing Freddy won't have the patience to learn everything Lawrence teaches. Cue the style and etiquette montage. After he's deemed ready, they do their first con together. In this one, it's basically the same backstory Lawrence has done with everyone else, and the woman has given him 100,000 francs in cash, and it appears that Lawrence has agreed to marry her. Now that he's confirmed that he's got the money, Lawrence mentions his brother Ruprecht. At first, the Mark is excited to meet the younger prince, but Lawrence takes her to a separate, dingy place on the estate where Ruprecht is staying, complete with a jail door and what appears to be a converted dungeon. Ruprecht, who is being played by Freddie, is a man-child who is definitely much more of a handful than this rich lady from Tulsa is going to be able to tolerate. Honestly, doing a summary like this does the whole thing an injustice because Steve Martin does some of the best acting ever here, most of it physical. In summary, Ruprecht is not going to be welcome at this family's house in Tulsa. The act is repeated at a dinner table with a woman from Florida, and of all of Ruprecht's antics in this section, the one where he asks permission to use the bathroom and then just sits there, never leaves, and it slowly dawns on everyone that he is using the bathroom right then and there is my favorite one. We see one more victim before it's time to divvy up the money, and Freddie is angered to learn he's only getting lessons, not any money. Lawrence claims Freddie needs to learn how to spend the money before receiving any, saying he needs to spend it on the finer things in life. But after seeing that those things only have look but don't touch value, Freddie gets fed up and decides he's going to go solo and leave town, which is exactly what Lawrence wanted. But it looks like that didn't last long. Freddie is already back in Beaumont-sur-Mer, and he tells Lawrence he was about to leave before realizing he loves being here. Lawrence says there isn't room for both of them, so Freddie threatens to wreck Lawrence's prospects. Lawrence, in turn, threatens Freddie with jail again, and then Freddie threatens Lawrence with Lady Fanny of Omaha. So they come up with a bet. Whomever is able to extract a certain amount from an agreed target is declared the winner and gets to stay. Just as they are agreeing to this deal, a commotion is heard outside and we are introduced to Janet Colgate, played by Glenna Headley, who is an heiress to a family fortune involving soap. Lawrence initially objects to making her a mark because she's so young, which Freddie teases, a little bit out of your league. When Lawrence suggests they scam $50,000 from her, he teases back, a little bit out of your league. So they agree that Janet will be the mark. We start out by seeing Janet at a roulette table in which Lawrence tries to repeat what he did with Fanny, except this time all the bets keep winning, and he can't do the bit about selling his ring. In the middle of all this, Freddie shows up wearing a Navy uniform and a wheelchair and butts into the middle of Janet and Lawrence. Freddie asks Janet to make a bet for him, which loses. He then asks her if she'll see if she can get some money for one of the medals he's wearing on his uniform, which the dealer denies. This subterfuge apparently works as Janet chases after Freddie and Lawrence wins yet another spin at roulette. As Janet chases after Freddie, he claims that that was his last chance he had at an operation. When she asks why the Navy wouldn't pay for that, he says, "Oh, it's not for me, it's my grandmother." Janet seems eager to help. Meanwhile, Lawrence cashes out his roulette winnings, which appear to be more than what he would win by scamming Janet. "Just one stroke of bad luck after another," he says ironically. In some sort of outside restaurant at the casino, Janet asks if an operation would help Freddie, but he tells her that his issue is not physical, it's emotional. He was engaged to a girl back in the States and they loved to dance, so they went on a show called Dance USA, and if they won, they'd get married. And they did indeed win, but she broke his heart when he found her dancing naked and having sex with Danny Terrio, the host of Dance USA. Janet thinks, by the way, I looked up the name. That name is actually on the IMDb, and he used to do stuff like back in the 70s and 80s, and he's a choreographer, so I'm assuming that's an inside joke from one of the writers. So Janet thinks that someone should be able to help him, and Freddie mentions there is a psychiatrist named Dr. Emil Schuffhausen who practices in Liechtenstein. Of course, he's in high demand and is expensive and charges $50,000 for his services. Janet laments that that is a lot of money, and it sounds like even she would have a hard time getting that kind of cash. But then Freddie sees two people dancing. He has an outburst, and Janet wheels him out of the restaurant. We find out Andre has been there taking notes. How has he heard everything from Faraway Table? Well, you've got to understand that people in movies can hear conversations anywhere and can zoom in on close-ups of things far away without binoculars as long as they're in the general area. Back at Janet's suite, she writes to Dr. Schaffhausen on Freddy's behalf. He asks her how in the world he's going to be able to get the money, and she tells him not to worry about it. After she leaves to mail the letter, Freddy does an I don't need a wheelchair dance. And just as Janet is about to put the letter in a box to be sent out from the hotel, wouldn't you know it, someone is paging a Dr. Schaffhausen right there. But of course, this fake person isn't really here. It's Lawrence posing as Dr. Schaffhausen, complete with a German accent. Luckily, he never said a word during the time they were playing roulette, because while Janet does recognize him, she never got to know him. Janet tells him she just sent him a letter about Freddy's condition, and Lawrence does what he does best, pretending that he'll look at it later and that Freddy's case isn't nearly important enough to interrupt his vacation. Nonetheless, Janet pushes the issue. When he keeps declining, Janet seems to imply that she can pay whatever fee he's looking for. When he asks her if she's given Freddy any money, she says only a little bit for his grandmother's operation, and he tells her to give him no more money because it could worsen his condition. In fact, if he does take this case, all fees go directly to him. So they go up to her suite and see him. Luckily for Freddy, she calls out his name while he's in another room so he can get back in his wheelchair. She tells him to cover his eyes and ask him who, besides his grandmother, would he like to see right now. And when he gives up, she unexpectedly says, Dr. Emil Schaffhausen, with a smiling Lawrence behind the door, wrecking Freddy's world. Michael Caine does a thing here that I love. He says, I am here to help you, my boy, and he leans in and gives Freddy a stern look that Janet can't see. Lawrence puts Freddy to the test, seeing if he can feel certain things, tickling his feet at first to torture him, and then pulling out a flower with it's something that comes out of a vase, with a long, thick stem to start whipping him in the legs with, lightly at first, then raising the intensity. Freddy is able to keep a poker face until Lawrence gets a running start and cracks him on the legs as hard as he can. But even though it's clearly painful and his eyes go wide, he's able to mask it because he didn't scream. And never underestimate the power of someone fully believing a story to mask any other reactions. Lawrence, seeing this won't work, tells Janet he will take the case and will treat him at his rented villa, and cracks the whip on Freddy some more. Freddy starts crying, which Janet believes is because he's so happy. Just as they're about to go, a Mrs. Reed recognizes him and starts talking to him like a prince, which Lawrence is able to cover for by saying she's an incurable patient of his. At the mansion, Freddy sees them walking up some stairs and says he'd like to join them. Lawrence says, of course you would. Come on. Janet doesn't seem to like the tough love approach, but what does she know? She's not a doctor. In a room upstairs, they start dancing, and Freddy pretends like he climbed up the stairs to find them doing the one thing that is his big emotional trigger. When Janet says it must be awful for him to see us like this, he agrees and simply closes the door. They continue to dance while Freddy moans outside. Freddy's next gambit is to pretend to have lost all hope and he's going to drown himself. They see him as he's about to make his descent down to the beach. Lawrence tells her it's a bluff to gain sympathy. Just when it looks like this isn't going to work, it appears Freddy thought at least two steps ahead and called in a fake satellite dish installer to come out and distract him so that he would leave and Janet would be more susceptible to her sympathy. Once Lawrence leaves to see about the satellite dish, Freddy pretends to roll his wheelchair down the stone steps and pretends to lose control of it. He's able to stage a crash, and now he's crawling towards the water as Janet comes running after him. She stands in front of him to prevent him from crawling any farther, and when he says he's just going to do this again when she's not looking, she vows to never leave him. Sounds good until she starts running to fetch Dr. Schaffhausen. Desperate Freddy tells her that he hates him, and even though she tells him that he's just being strict, she decides to stay with him down on the beach. It's here Freddy starts trying to play like he's in love with Janet and hoping that she loves him back. They're about to kiss when an angry Dr. Schaffhausen shows up on the beach to tell her that he's going to drop the case until she pleads with him and he gives it another chance. Lawrence tells her that maybe if they enjoy themselves and do things that Freddy will want to do, it will make him jump out of the wheelchair and he'll be cured. Cue a short activities montage, which ends up at a dance club. Lawrence teases Freddy, but this time there are British naval officers sitting behind him who don't take kindly to his taunts. Freddy tells him that Janet used to be his girl, and he thinks that he could get her back if he was out of the way. The last straw is when Lawrence asks Janet to kiss him, telling her he thinks it's possible that love will get him to stand up, which she agrees to, and then Lawrence gives Freddy a devilish grin. After the dancing is over and dropping her off at the hotel, Janet tells Lawrence that she had to raise the money for Freddy's operation. He asks her why she had to do that, and she reveals that she merely won a contest from a soap company, and her father had to sell a car, furniture, and jewelry to raise the money for Freddy. She's not an heiress at all. Janet's goodwill towards people she doesn't even know impresses Lawrence very much, telling her he didn't know that people like her existed. On the drive home, Lawrence tells Freddy they can't make Janet the target because she's not wealthy and she's definitely not corrupt. Freddy thinks he's trying to get out of the bet, but then he is finally convinced that they shouldn't take her money. However, he proposes a new wager. Whoever is able to get her to sleep with them wins the bet. Lawrence doesn't want to play this game, but he agrees to a bet where he will not try to win. He's betting that Freddy just won't be able to get Janet in bed. Back at the mansion, the waiting British naval officers kidnap Lawrence to put him on a transport plane to Honduras. Freddy immediately heads over to Janet's hotel suite to try to get her to sleep with him. He pretends that she's the only one who can get him out of the wheelchair and that she could inspire him to do so. He tells her he loves her. He thinks he'll walk if she'll love him too. She tells him she loves him and then tries to inspire him by encouraging him to stand up and walk over to her. Accompanied by a stirring score, Freddy pretends like he is finally able to stand after so many years and that Janet's words of encouragement are breaking down his psychological barriers. He makes her stand next to the bed in the other room, pretending like he wants to see how far he can walk now. She does, and even says she'll kiss him if he can make it. Halfway through this inspiring triumph of courage, he even manages to start taking off his clothes in anticipation of the sex he's going to have. Just as he's about to kiss her, they are interrupted. Somehow, Lawrence is in the room. Somehow, he beat Freddy there. Somehow, Lawrence is a Royal Navy Volunteer Reserve, and he was able to talk his way out of the plane to Honduras. According to Janet, he predicted everything Freddy would try to do tonight. What a great doctor he is. They leave Janet's suite, and as Freddy promises he's seriously going to put on the charm to get Janet into bed, they walk to another suite where the sailors from earlier are all having a party, and they've been briefed on the fact that Freddy was faking being unable to walk. Even worse for Freddy, Lawrence is making sure Janet leaves in the morning while Freddy is detained by the angry sailors at the party. The next morning, Lawrence is all but shoving Janet onto a plane, and despite the fact that she might love Freddy, he tells her that if he really does love her, he'll find her. She asks about the fee, and Lawrence says if she does what he tells her, she can keep the fee. Back at the hotel party, Lawrence comes back to gloat. It looks like Freddy somehow turned those sailors around on him because it looks like he's fine. He's just standing there, hand propped up against a doorway, cutting up with one of the sailors. But when they all leave, Freddy asks for some super glue solvent. Apparently, they glued his hand to the doorway all night. 6 hours is what he says. Lawrence points out a plane in the sky and tells Freddy that Janet is on it and he's lost the bet. Nonetheless, Freddy makes a desperate attempt and runs back to Janet's suite, but it appears to be empty. But just when all is lost, Janet shows up. She doesn't care that her showing up might mess up his recovery. She really is in love with him. So now it appears they're going to sleep together. She tells him to close the drapes and close the door, and she unbuttons her shirt. Andre calls Lawrence to tell him that Janet was seen going back to the hotel and that Freddy is with her, and that it's definitely been long enough. Lawrence is ready to concede defeat to the jackal. Lawrence waits for Freddy, but is surprised by a crying Janet, who tells him that after they had sex, she fell asleep and that Freddy ran off with all of her valuables, including a $50,000 check she got to pay the fee. She believes now that Freddy could walk all along and he pretended to be in a wheelchair to get her money. He tells his butler to call Andre and arrest Freddy. Then he pulls out a bunch of cash from his safe to pay back Janet's losses, puts it in a bag, and will make sure she gets on a plane this time. At the airport, Janet is about to get on the plane, but then she comes back and gives him the bag full of money, saying that she can't possibly accept it because it doesn't belong to her. Shortly after Janet boards the plane, Andre comes driving into the airport to tell Lawrence he found Freddie at the hotel, returning to the scene of the crime. Lawrence tells Freddie she's on the plane and she's safe from him, but Freddie says, "You let her go? We have to stop her." Apparently, after Janet told Freddie to close the drapes and the door, she told him to take a shower. And when he was done with that, she was gone with all of his stuff, even taking the 2,000 francs she gave him for the fake for his fake grandmother's operation. Lawrence says, "You expect me to believe that when she just returned the $50,000 I gave her?" Freddie yells, "What $50,000? The $50,000 you stole from her." Freddie says, "I didn't steal $50,000 from her." And that's when they look at the bag and find out that there's no money in it. It just has Freddie's clothes in it and a note that says, "Hello, boys. It was fun. I'll miss you. Love, Janet, the Jackal. Also, P.S. I'm keeping the money. Is that wrong?" Freddie, getting a taste of his own medicine, realizing he's been had, runs through the thesaurus, calling her every word for liar he can think of. And Lawrence, in one of my favorite lines, says, "Yes, isn't she wonderful?" Back at the villa, Freddie prepares to leave after he granted Freddie an extra week. He sits by Lawrence on a bench and asks, "When do you think she knew?" And he says, "From the beginning, Freddie. She was on to us from the very beginning." As they say their goodbyes, they are interrupted by a gaggle of old people walking up the steps. Janet is now talking in a nearly Fran Drescher-like voice now, leading the group, which just came off a yacht. Janet is in full character, introducing Lawrence as an Australian man by the name of Chips O'Toole. Lawrence doesn't know quite what to do at first, but eventually decides what the hell and conjures up an Australian accent to properly greet the Greek gentleman in front of him. Janet then introduces the guy to Freddie, but claims he's unable to speak. After the yacht party goes up to the house, Janet, back in what may or may not be her real voice, comes back to tell Freddie and Lawrence that she made $3 million last year, but that their $50,000 was the most fun. Now she proposes a team up to rob all these yacht people blind. And that's how the movie ends. Guys, what did you think of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels?
Aaron, take it away.
Oh, will do. This movie is pure magic. I love this movie. I think it's in my top 100 of all time. I haven't looked at exactly where it sits. It's moving up after this viewing. Every time I see it, it's probably going to move up. It's just so well done on so many levels, and I'm laughing throughout. There are so many reasons. I will go into a few of them. I will say, Chris, you mentioned this is our second Frank Oz Bic recommend. It's actually our third. In and of itself was also directed by Frank Oz, too. So
that's right.
To bring that up. I think I did a little bit of a deep dive into the writers on this because it feels like an old school, like, back and forth Sturgis era, you know, comedy where the dialogue is just sharp and every sentence that's said is important. And the three writers on this were, first of all, a couple guys named Paul Henning and Stanley Shapiro and Paul Henning were two of the three writers on this. They wrote on the George Burns pilot. The old George Burns show in 1950. These guys have been writing comedy like this for decades when they do Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. They are joined by Dale Lawner, who also wrote My Cousin Vinny. So there's a little bit of that in there as well. But once I looked at it, I was like, oh, that makes complete sense because it feels like, you know, an old school comedy in that way where all the lines are perfectly written and mean something. One of my favorite examples of that is when I think they're in the prison and Steve Martin says something like, I fell in love with another woman and got caught. You French should know something about that. And he says, "To fall in love with another woman, that is French. To get caught, that is American." And I'm just like, that's a throwaway line, and it's perfect. It's so funny, and the movie is full of that kind of stuff. Then you get into the fact that Steve Martin is just at his absolute best in this movie. He is People like to think like Jim Carrey invented physical comedy sometimes, and you go back and you watch, you know, Steve Martin and something like this, and you're like, okay, this is every bit as inventive and fun and crazy as Ace Ventura is. You know what I mean? Like, maybe Ventura is a little more over the top, but like, he is so good with his body movements and his, you know, when he is playing Rupert, it is just, it's gold, man. Like, I'm just laughing so much. Through all that, I also think the movie succeeds on the juxtaposition between him and Michael Caine. It's just this perfect 1-2 punch of the debonair English con artist and like artiste, like a con artiste, and then just, you know, the scammer, you know, the con man scammer. And the movie really lets them fully be those characters, even right up to the end when, you know, she says he is unfortunately mute. And so he can't talk. She does that because she knows he's not as good as they are. He's just this, you know, like it doesn't ever play that card of actually he's outsmarting them both, even though he seemed like the dumb one. No, he actually is kind of the clod of the three. Mm-hmm. And the movie just lets him be that, which I think is really, really good. The other thing I wanted to mention, the setups and payoffs are just exquisite. In this movie, you mentioned my favorite one, which is the setup of Michael Caine's scheme at the table, and then the payoff of him, winning. Maybe on purpose, or maybe the jackal set that up somehow.
You certainly goes through your head after you've watched this movie the first time and then watch it again that maybe she manipulated that roulette table. So yeah.
Then just with that line, you know, just one stroke of bad luck after another as he's cashing hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's just so good. I think the other thing I would mention is there are two really great montages in this movie. And montages have become a little bit out of fashion, and I get it, but when they're done right in a comedy, comedic montages can be gold because you get to learn a lot about, you know, these characters, what they're doing, and it's a chance for multiple quick punchlines. You know what I mean? So, like, the montages, I think, in this are a great example of how you do those really, really well. And the twists at the end are perfect. Not only does she get them, she's the jackal, and the movie hides that so well because you just assume he's the jackal. Like, it's just a given that Steve Martin is the jackal, and the fact that she is at the end is just a perfect, perfect twist at the end. So, yeah, man, I can't say enough good stuff about this movie.
She has that perfectly sweet, like, there's just absolute, like, every time I watch this movie, I'm still convinced that she's not conning them.
Yeah.
Like, I know in the back of my mind, she's conning them, but when I'm watching it again, and this is probably 20th to 25th time that I watched this movie, it's, she's so sweet and innocent about everything that it never gives off any kind of hint.
There's one slight right at the beginning.
Dumps all the stuff.
Yes, she dumps the stuff in the movie. There's a close up, and she gives a wry look just for a second. I mean, I noticed that this time. And again, I did mention earlier, you know, how underrated she is. She is so good in this, and I think she did Mr. Holland's Opus and or something recently.
Searching for Bobby Fischer. That was Joan Allen. I think
there's something recently she was in. Oh, Don Juan. She was in Don Juan, the Joseph Gordon-Levitt movie. I thought she was good in that, too. But, yeah, and I wish she had had a broader career because I love her in this. I think she's so good at what she does. But, yeah.
Yeah, and she unfortunately, like, died young, too. She was, like, 52 or 62. 62,
I think.
Somewhere around there, but yeah, she agreed. One of the somebody who really I would have liked to have seen more of over the years, but Mr. Holland's Opus is another one. I brought that one up a few weeks ago. She's fantastic in that,
It's no surprise to me that this movie has had staying power. I know that it didn't really go anywhere, but actually the three writers I mentioned reteamed to write The Hustle in 2019 with Anne Hathaway.
Yeah, I wonder, are these screenwriters being credited because their original material is in the movie, or did they come back to help rewrite? I feel like in this instance, It feels like they're just using some of bedtime story in this movie, so they just go ahead and give them the screenwriting credit. Usually, they say, based on the screenplay by when they do that, but they don't do that here. I just find it weird that, I don't know how many years later, they're still credited as the people who wrote on this movie, even though, you know, it's a remake.
I would love to do an even deeper dive, because you're right. It very much could be that they had the guy from, you know, My Cousin Vinny write the script, and then those guys advised on it and actually put a few lines in or whatever. But I know for the 2019 movie, they added another writer. I think it was the showrunner for WandaVision. I can't remember her name, but I think she was credited on that script as well. But yeah, you never know how people get those credits, but they're definitely screenwriting credits. They're not story by credits. They're screenwriting credits. So
I just wondered if there was like some new rule or some old rule that they're going by on that one, where it's like, well, we used enough material from the old movie to just give you straight up credit instead of saying based upon, or it might've been a part of their contract when they did Bedtime Story or whatever.
Yeah.
I tried to look up the old bed. You can't find Bedtime Story on streaming. You can't even find it free on YouTube. But I did find clips of it, and there are scenes in there that look almost exactly like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Marlon Brando is playing the Steve Martin role, and David Niven is playing the Michael Caine role. And there's scenes in there that look exactly like, even shot exactly like the old movie. But I'm sure there's a lot. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot more here that they're doing with this. Steve Martin is clearly doing something that was not done in the original movie. So
yeah, and there was a musical too.
There's something about we forget how good Steve Martin is at physical comedy, because he is so smart, and he is like, if you've seen any time since Only Murders in the Building came out, if you've seen him and Martin Short interviewed, like, they are lightning quick wit, like, and that, I think, is what he's known for today. But if you go back to his SNL appearances early in the day, or The Jerk, or this movie, like, it's physical comedy. And I wanted to point out, you guys have already said everything I wanted to say, but I wanted to talk a little bit about that scene where he's getting tickled, and he makes these faces that are perfection. Like, I don't know that anyone else could quite do that scene the way he does. Like, the first time he tickles him, and he's like, you know, he turns his head, the way he shows us he's feeling.
That last one where he puts his fingers through his temples. Yes.
And so another thing that he's really good at is fumbling words. Like, when he's trying to think of Lawrence's name in the jail cell, it reminds me of the Pink Panther when he's trying to say the word hamburger. Mm. He's really good at that. But the jail scene combines that kind of verbal comedy with physical comedy as he's grabbing the bars and trying hard to remember. And I just, this viewing, like, I took his performance for granted the first 10 times I saw this movie, because I was a teenager or in college or something. But I just think, you put another actor in that role and this whole movie falls apart. I mean, I think all three of them are excellent and strong, and they all need to be here. But there's something physical to the role of Freddy that is singularly Steve Martin. I also think the end is perfect. I think it is the only way this movie can end, and it is absolutely perfection. And you guys have talked about Glenn Headley being, you know, going, matching these guys. These are Hollywood heavyweights, and she's not a Hollywood heavyweight when she's making this movie, but acting-wise, she's doing every bit as much as they are. I love that they teach him to be a suave gentleman and to lean against the thing and put his hand in his pocket, and then the first role they give him is Rupert.
Yep.
I think that's intentional. Like, I think Lawrence is fucking with him.
Oh, yeah.
I love that.
Well, and even when he finally gets it at the end, and he and Michael Caine claps and whatever, he's so clearly not good at doing whatever he's been taught. It's so hammy and everything, but Michael Caine is willing to be like, you know, may have frozen up there, but Michael Caine is like sitting there like, yeah, that's what I wanted the whole time, even though it's so hammy and weird what he's doing. And so anyway,
I don't understand how she is onto them, and I guess we just have to assume she's every bit as good at research as Lawrence is,
yeah,
and has been observing them in the background for days or weeks to target them. I kind of like that the movie doesn't give us an obvious reason, and certainly that would probably tip its hand if we saw it in the background.
And this is not our jobs as people who send movies for a living or whatever, but like, you know, we don't usually give the movie the benefit of the doubt. We'd probably openly question why she knows this stuff. But if you're giving the movie the benefit of the doubt, first off, Freddie is not being coy or being very quiet about what he's doing at all. Like, he sticks out like a sore thumb. But Lawrence isn't either. I mean, I think about that scene that he has. Dana Ivey plays the character that recognizes him. When they're putting on that Dr. Schaffhausen show or whatever. I'm surprised that hasn't happened more often, considering how often he shows up around these society places and everything.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, someone has to know that he's misrepresenting himself when he says he's a prince out there. But apparently, you know, he's been able to get away with it. So that's one of those things that I think that, you know, if she really did, like, sort of case the place before she came in, she would have been able to figure that out fairly quickly if she wanted to. But that's my only guess.
Freddie makes two big mistakes in this movie, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Choosing to go the wheelchair route.
It
initially feels brilliant because it's going to get the sympathy angle, but then it completely hamstrings him for the next 30 minutes of the movie. But also, he should have stipulated no helpers. Because Lawrence has this cop out here this whole time, eavesdropping, taking notes.
Yeah.
And there's this huge advantage in the bet that Steve Martin didn't have any helpers.
Right.
He didn't have any police captains helping him out. So
yep.
He really walked into a bad bet, but that is true to the character of Freddy. So it works.
Yeah.
I also, the last thing I wanted to point out, and it's dumb, but there's a line early in the movie where Steve Martin says, "It is better to be truthful and good." than to not.
So good.
All right.
Yep. You were talking about, you know, wanting a little more, like, set up with her, like how she got the jump on him. I thought, like, if I could add one thing to this movie, the guy that told them, like, she's the soap queen of, you know, such and such, I wanted him to be, like, her accomplice.
Oh, yeah.
And then at the end, for him to be on that tour with them as some sort of other character or something would have been, like, a wink to earlier, oh, when he told them all that stuff, she was having him, you know, tell them all that stuff.
So, I actually had the passing thought of that when I saw that dude giving the lowdown. I was like, he doesn't... Yeah. Michael Caine doesn't usually get his lowdown from just randos in a hotel. Mm-hmm. So anyway, all right, let's do our super secret double feature.
This Black Friday, get 6 months free when you move your WordPress sites to Kinsta. Enjoy faster load times, no stress when traffic spikes, and hosting you can actually count on. We're G2's number one rated host for WordPress for a reason. Visit kinsta.com/BF. That's KINSTA.com/BF. Don't miss out. Offer ends December 2nd.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I really don't think Aaron's going to choose mine, and that means he has, of course. But I will brave going first. What I was looking for in a double feature was a mentor... protege relationship that also had elements of a rivalry and then ultimately respect. And that's why I went with The Color of Money.
Where
Paul Newman takes Tom Cruise under his wing to teach him how to be better at pool and how to hustle people. But they're also kind of rivals, not necessarily for the woman, but in the end, in the world of pool. But then by the end of the film, they have respect for each other. And so I just think that would be a nice pairing here. Not tonally, but topically.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I kind of had two different avenues to go as well. One of them kind of being that same avenue as you, Jeremy, with Trading Places, I thought might have been interesting in that aspect. But I ended up going with The Lady Eve because, number one, because I don't think enough people have seen this movie. And number two, it's a very con artist story where the... there's not really a turn like there is in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, but it's definitely funny and has that quick repartee. And it's this is a good one I've seen just recently that really felt like a good, you know, back to back with this. So yeah,
interesting.
I am kind of happy that none of you said Spanish Prisoner, because when Jeremy did Spanish Prisoner, my super secret double feature was Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. So sort of like an Ouroboros of recommendations there. All right. Okay. So we have two things going on now here. First off, it'll be next week's homework, and we have an announcement. And Jeremy, I'll let you take that away.
The homework for next week was almost my super secret double feature for this movie. We'll be carrying on the theme of con men, and we're going to watch Matchstick Men.
Nice.
With Nicolas Cage, and it is on... Shit.
It's on... I don't have that streaming service.
Apple...
That's not a service you want to be a streaming service. That's
one day there. Hang on. One day, Aaron. One day.
Hang on.
You want more of a solid service, not a streaming service from that network.
Yes.
I can't spell. All right. It's on Apple or Plex.
Oh, okay.
Or Zumo or Pluto TV.
Okay. All right.
Nope. That was wrong. Hang on. Sorry. This is comical. Okay, it's on Apple or Roku or Canopy. Okay.
Okay. All right. Okay. So the announcement here is this is our next to last episode. Next week will be our last episode that we do. Jeremy and I are going to be stepping back a little bit and sort of more behind the scenes kind of stuff at the CinemaSins, in the CinemaSins world. And so this next episode will be the last one that we do. And
for Wreckatopia, we should tell them to keep their feeds open, because there's every chance that another show will come along.
That's correct.
Down the line.
Yes. So, I'm almost certain next week we will do a lot more talking about it, but this is sort of a hey, giving you a heads up that instead of at the end of Matchstick Men saying, well, that's it, guys, see ya, bye, you know, that type of thing. So I know that I will miss doing this particular thing, and I love that you guys in chat have been coming out here. See, some of you guys are so regular every week and whatever, and I will miss this but it is time for us to do the new things. So that's where we're going on that one. So yes, and everybody is giving the hearts and frownies and
yes,
stuff.
We love you guys,
and we're definitely gonna miss you guys and miss doing this. So Aaron, you got anything to say?
I'll probably say more next week, I would say, like Jeremy said, to make sure that you keep this feed on whatever you're listening to it on, because you never know what's going to pop up next. We've seen this with other podcasts that change or shift or evolve or those kind of things, and who knows what's next, but you know, this has certainly been an absolutely beautiful chapter, and I will probably speak more on it next week, but yeah.
Alrighty. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Once again, thank you guys for coming out, and we will be ready to go our last one next week. And that's going to be it for today. We'll see you next time. See ya.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
I've never seen this piece of art for Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. I've never seen that. It's weird. It looks airbrushed.
Yeah.
AI generated it. Just kidding. Just kidding. Just kidding.
There's an AI country song at the top of the country charts.
Oh, yeah. I heard about that, too.
I totally missed that. That's kind of hilarious.
Have you guys ever seen a YouTube channel called Yes Theory?
I know I have, but I can't.
They're like a
upright.
They're like a travel channel, but they go to these places that people rarely ever talk about and try to find the stories about them. And I just watched one today. I've seen a few Yes Theory. They're slowly becoming like a must watch channel for me.
But, nice.
But yeah, they had this one that came out, I guess, yesterday, where they visited these Northern Mariana Islands that are American territories that are close to Japan. And one of the islands was used for the planes that went to Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Oh, wow.
And very few people knew that that's what these islands were used for, but they're American territory. So you see, they have two native languages there, but of course, mostly they can speak English there too. And, you know, they sound like Californians or whatever, but they went through and, they were looking for somebody who could tell them the history of the island, maybe who knew anything about World War II. And they ran into this dude who's like 94 years old, but still like he looks like 80 something years old, but he acts like he's still probably in his 50s or 60s or something like that. Very well put together guy. And he showed them like, yeah, we were during the Japanese raids, we were huddled in this cave and, you know, he talked about all the history of like Japan being there and, just a lot of just really cool stuff on there. They've also gone to some places where they built a whole city, but nobody ever lived there, somewhere around, Malaysia, I believe. And they went through all these there's people who live there. But it's not like a fully functioning city, and it's just like empty hotels and like occasional places to go to eat or whatever. But like just a city that was built for something just never got to that point, you know?
Yeah, interesting.
So yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff.
Hey, you guys were right about Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
You say you guys. I don't know that I've officially given my opinion, which isn't as high as everybody else's, but... But yeah.
Oh, I forgot that you were wrong all the time.
I do occasionally, or more than occasionally, become wrong about things. Yeah, it's a little style over substance for me, but it's beautiful to look at.
I'm pretty impressed with Jacob Elordi though, because Euphoria. Like, I feel like there, like a lot of actors could play the character he plays in Euphoria, just like the brooding, bully, angry guy. But then he plays Elvis in Priscilla. And then he does this, and now he's in that Wuthering Heights with Margot Robbie. And I think the dude has range, man. I'm pretty impressed.
Yeah, he's good.
He reminds me kind of how Pattinson started off, where, you know, what Pattinson did was, you know, you saw him in Twilight. Most people recognized him from Twilight, and it was like, oh, he must be the Twilight guy. He must suck. And then he went on and... did great work after that.
We've had two instances of this. We had Twilight, where Kristen Stewart and Robert Pattinson were both considered bad actors, and they've both turned out to be wonderful actors. And then in 50 Shades, we have Dakota Johnson and dude whose name I always forget, and they were considered dull, bland actors, and they've both gone on to prove that they're actually really excellent actors.
Yeah, Jamie Dornan.
So we need a third sexy teen book adaptation. So we can have the trifecta for another pair of actors that seem bad at first, but then actually turn out to be quite good.
Well, you know, they're looking for a break like anybody else, and they found the biggest break you could possibly get. And then suddenly you're like, oh, that's your thing, huh? You like being in Twilight and 50 Shades and stuff like that. That's your type of thing. But then. Yeah, you have to have smart management a lot of times too.
Yeah.
Who tell you like you probably get offers for all the things that are sort of like Twilight, after that.
Well, and even like she went to Snow White and the Huntsman after Twilight, which is another big budget kind of, you know, payday kind of thing. And then I think somewhere in there she was like, wait, oh, I want to be a good actress. And from after that movie, it's like she wasn't in the sequel to the Snow White and the Huntsman. And then she just started making really interesting choices one after another.
And also the being in those movies help you have a financial floor to do that type of thing too.
That
you can't underestimate that either. Cause Daniel Radcliffe, ever since Harry Potter.
Yes.
I mean, he's done nothing that's commercial since then. And
no, I don't think a single thing.
He's so good in Merrily We Roll Along. The Broadway show that the Sondheim show that they just brought to film. I just got a screener of that. I was like, oh man.
Really?
Yeah, Jonathan Groff and Radcliffe, and I forget the woman's name. They're so good, those three together. Yeah,
I don't know anything about that show.
Well, it's also it's a good time to learn because Linklater's doing that show or that story, Merrily We Roll Along, for his next like extended shoot, because the story starts in the future and then just goes backwards. So like every new scene is like 15 years ago, and so he's shooting like he did with Boyhood with an actual cast and shooting it in actual time. So I think he's supposed to be done in like 15 years or something like that with that.
Well, I mean, I appreciate the ambition there, but what if you get hit by a car?
I mean, you know, it could happen.
It becomes an unfinished work, or you have to come up with something that explains it.
Yeah, I don't get it. I really don't get it.
Ethan Hawke, I said it before, man, Ethan Hawke had one hell of a like busy last year, to do all the stuff that he did. I mean, I'm sure that there's some stuff that got made long ago and it's just now coming out, but you know, that's how you get those weird, like, that director came out with two movies in one year. It's usually because they made one movie that took forever to come out or whatever.
Yeah, I just actually last night watched Black Phone 2. Finally got around to watching that.
Yeah, he's still on top of that. Did that too.
Yep. Although you never see his face in that movie.
That's true. He could have phoned it in.
Hey,
he only wears a mask.
Hey, I love it.
It's weird. Like, you can condense Black Phone down to, what if there was a kidnapper, but what if he kidnapped the wrong kids who have psychic abilities? It was I think when I was sending that, I was like sitting there going like, what a contrivance that these kids just happen to have psychic abilities. And then I was like, wait a minute, that's actually the point. Like, he's kidnapping a whole bunch of kids and these just happen to have psychic abilities. After, it wasn't the first ones he picked up, it was like the 10th or 12th or whatever. So
no, but the convenience that all the different spoilers, I guess, if you haven't seen it, but convenience that all the different kidnapped kids have the exact piece of the puzzle.
Oh, that was definitely sinned. I'm almost certain, because it was like Slumdog Millionaire for getting out of a basement.
Exactly, yeah.
I'll never forget that in the beginning, him saying to the baseball player, your arm is mint. Like, I use that people don't talk like that.
They did then.
I don't think they did, Aaron.
Well, it's funny, in Black Phone 2, it was choice. She just kept saying things were choice.
Mm.
Really?
They may have. They may have. I mean, baseball players, like, kids who are collecting baseball cards and they learn about conditions being mint may have said that your arm is mint or whatever. I don't know. It does sound awkward. I agree with you, Jeremy. I'm on your side. So.
Okay. Well,
Yeah, I wasn't quite alive then. So
choice makes sense.
When
choice
does it take
place? I heard choice a lot.
70s, what? Early 70s, I think. Okay. So the second one is more late 70s, I think.
By the time I was playing Little League, it was just your arm is awesome or you're a good pitcher. We didn't have this fancy 70s lingo.
I don't know. We had rad. Rad isn't really a thing anymore.
Rad only stuck around for like 9 months, man, and it was glorious.
Yeah.
You have an arm what we used to call mint.